Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to AMANDLA, your weekly bilingual news show with briefings and analysis from the continent of Africa here at CKUT 90.3 FM on your dial. Been doing this for a while and we're happy to bring this material to you. And Gwen, what is the programming tonight?
Well, it really is about the material we bring to you, because what we've decided to do tonight and what seems to be perhaps an eternal year-end wrap-up of 2020, but this is, we wanted to do this because what we're bringing you tonight is our original content, interviews that we did over 2020 that we think stood out, that we think make an original contribution. So we will each be presenting two or three clips of interviews that we did over the course of the show, explaining why they were important to us and we hope to you, and then playing an excerpt from each one.
Yes, good evening, everyone, AMANDLA friends and listeners. It's Helden here. And like Gwen said, I can't wait to listen to what our year has been. And if this was a class, this is the revision one. Revision.
Nicely put.
Thank you. Stay tuned to AMANDLA. Bora san kaluta ni fila kono kamenya nina anga mo kasa dungudu ko kele munte ban odida bora anta si kanda minisa kanga dikuto ka fir polusa ko ku normine ko bisuit mine le se ku chefe ku bani mine pa 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 Bora uyu kali kute kitali sini auma anga duku peka chitungudu surukudu na kakati hinana anga mago beka murutisa kuteka firi jelasa uko mpufa umine kubamba umine kilise kunchefe kubanda amine
has come in. Welcome back to AMANDLA here on CKUT 90.3 FM, CKUT.ca around the world. And here we are, Helden, Doug, and myself, Gwen. We are taking a look back at 2020 and AMANDLA's original contribution to news and analysis on Africa. And what we mean by that are original interviews or interviews we did with people that we feel have significant things to say about the continent. A lot of it related to COVID and its impact on Africa, but not all of it. So we've each kind of chosen a couple of our favorite pieces, but we thought we'd just start by going around the table. Well, the theoretical table, because we're all in our separate spaces, but
Zoom
around
table.
The metaphorical table, and just kind of throw out a couple of the things that we felt really were particularly proud of. So Heldon, let's start with you. You did a whole bunch of stuff this year on Amandla, which was amazing. What stood out for you? Some of it will play tonight. Some of it people can find on our archives, but yeah, go ahead.
Yes, thanks, Gwen. For my 2020, I think I focused more on what was happening, trying to understand what is the ongoing events. For example, my conversations with Ole were surrounding the realities of Mali and northern Mozambique. And I tried to just understand what is going on in my interviews with him, because most of the time people seem to just say, okay, well, this is happening, or the dictator has been taken out of their seat, but no one really goes into details with you to tell you this is actually the root cause of the whole thing. So that was really my focus on my interviews this year. And of course, my favorite was with Ameth, where we talked about the realities of Mali, but also he touched on a few of the things that other surrounding countries around Mali could be doing or are doing based off the youth of these countries. And I'm excited to revisit it and see what my thoughts are from then until now, as things have happened throughout. So
amazing.
Yeah.
Good. And Doug, what about you? What did you pull out as a couple
of
your faves?
Oh my gosh. Well, we started the year by just a small tribute to Bobby Wine, who was already facing a huge oppression in his country and opposition from the ruling regime of Museveni.
In Uganda.
And Uganda. And wouldn't you know it, here we are in the new year and it's starting all over the same. So it's most appropriate that I'm going to just play one piece of his music and we'll bring up the issues around his election probably in the next few weeks when we get some more background on it. But we also followed up on Algeria. We interviewed Brahim from New York about what was going on in Algeria. We interviewed Dua a couple of times about the situation in Sudan, with vis-a-vis COVID, vis-a-vis Darfur. With Uli, we also brought up the whole business of Mau Mau. And there was a new book on the Mau Mau and Dedan Kamati that had just come out. And so we did that with Uli to talk about that, and then I was very impressed with everything that's happened since Black Lives Matter came up, and it's really been an interesting evolution how Black Lives Matter has sprung out of America to be even taken up by the movement in Nigeria, for instance, where there was a great deal of inspiration from the Black Lives Matter in the anti-SARS and the end of harassment movement that was enough is enough. And I was also impressed with the number of activist musicians in particular who stood up and started promoting these causes. Inu Moja from Mali, Tiwa, I've just forgotten her last name, from Nigeria. So that's what grabbed me over the year, and I've got a couple pieces around that to play as well.
Super. And so for myself, well, I really revisited the whole thing around resource grabbing in Africa. So that's land and other resources. And I was particularly interested in how COVID, in the context of COVID, what did it mean for these struggles on the continent? Did it open a door to a radical reinterpretation and understanding of the theft of these resources, or has it further entrenched that phenomenon? So I spoke to a couple of people about that, as well as COVID as a disease and how it's grappled with, for instance, in a country like Sierra Leone that has a history of dealing with a far more rapacious and dangerous disease, Ebola. So they come to the whole COVID thing in a kind of interesting perspective and possibly serve as an an example, not just for the continent, but for the world. So those are some of the stories that I am bringing to the show this week. So please stay tuned to Amandla. We'll be right back with some of those.
The bad news is that everyone is a potential victim. But the good news is that everyone is a potential solution. Sensitize the masses to sanitize. Keep a social distance and quarantine. Stop!
The coronavirus is sweeping over mankind.
Everybody must be alert. It's a global pandemic we can never take for granted. Wash your hands, keep a distance from everyone. Report anything like a symptom. Serious fever is a symptom. Dry cough is a symptom. Walk with Tamala is a symptom. Itchy eyes and flu is a symptom.
So this year I had the opportunity to turn to one of my favorite go-to people when it comes to land grabbing and resource grabbing, and that's Devlin Kuyek of the organization Grain. And so we had a long rambling conversation, but part of it really was about the impact of COVID on land grabbing in Africa and around the world.
Most of the African continent gets its food, for instance, from the informal sector. So, you know, supermarkets and these sort of more, what they call the more formal sector, provide very little when it comes to people's food. So if you shut down and lock down the informal sector, you're essentially starving people, moving them their livelihoods with starving people. And there have been very interesting struggles and initiatives that have come about in South Africa, a really strong effort, for instance, to have the informal sector recognized as, you know, one of the most important, or if not the most important,
as a formal sector.
As formal, exactly. And that any response needs to, you know, figure out ways to facilitate the functioning of the, mm-hmm. the informal sector. You know, and in cases where we've been pushing back a lot in this narrative that, oh, you know, these wet markets are to blame, for instance, in Asia for being the source and spread of the disease, or a lot of people have said the same of markets in Latin America. But really, you know, these markets, many of them there would have been numerous markets in different areas. With the explosion of the slum areas and the violent crackdown that usually happens on informal sellers, they get pushed to very like crowded areas as well. So the whole like way in which this sector has been treated so disdainfully, basically criminalized, has made it also very vulnerable to the situation. So part of the response has to be, how can we, you know, create a spaces and a food system and trade and distribution chains in the so-called informal sector that is safe? You know, that should be the assumption. But of course, the World Bank and none of the development agencies, they have zero understanding of what that looks like. So it's meant also that people have to look elsewhere for solutions right now. And I think that's what's really interesting, is you're seeing this rise of sort of mutual aid or different initiatives that farmers are taking on themselves and connecting with urban groups. So you're seeing a total mushroom beginning of that. And that is incredible. I think definitely people having a growing sense, from what my colleagues and the people I know in Africa are telling me, that a growing sense of the importance of local food, the importance of having some more food sovereignty in the country, and the problems with this dependence on imports, and the dependence on these foreign companies that that people don't no longer trust. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I mean, one of our great worries right now is that there was an emerging debt crisis already. I don't know if you've talked about this on the show, but there's been a huge increase over the last years in the amount of debt that is owed by countries in the global south. And much of that debt is owed to private creditors. So they can be pension funds, they can be BlackRock, it can be all kinds of different private sector companies. And with this economic crisis, and many of these are dollar denominated, so you're going to have this real difficulty for governments. It's already happening to repay these debts. There will be a debt crisis. And those debts will be negotiated with not only the IMF and the World Bank, which is bad enough, but with these private lenders now. And the recipe is going to be the same as it always has been. It's going to be structural adjustment. It's going to be, produce more export commodities to get these dollars so you can pay us off. Yep. And cut back on your healthcare and your social programs.
A consolidation of the status quo, or yes, the trend that's existed
for and rapid sell off of natural resources and land. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be, I think, a huge conflict that's going to be building now. Is already it's hard enough to stomach what's being imposed. As this new second wave of structural adjustment comes in, what is that going to mean, and how are people going to organize to fight against this? It's going to require not just strong on the ground organizing, but also I think a lot of international solidarity. And we hear, we've talked about the investment of the pension funds in Quebec and Canada, and I think that's something we can start to look at. Are our pension funds invested in African debt right now? They probably are. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are they invested in the mining companies and others who are going to be taking advantage of this crisis? They most certainly are. So there's a lot of work to be done here as well when it comes to that. I mean, we'll be facing our own issues, of course, but I mean, it's, that's something that we have an intimate involvement in when it comes to what's going to be playing out in Africa.
It's a dark portrait, Devlin, and I always try to end on a positive point, but in a sort of interesting and strange way, it is a positive point in the sense that what you just said potentially empowers Quebecers and Canadians to take action here in solidarity with people struggling there. And, so much of the problem does lie here, right, in our countries in terms of all of these structural inequalities, and to be taking on the pension funds and drawing those connections between Canada and Africa and elsewhere in the world is positive in the sense that it can empower people to take action for change.
Yes, and I think shatters also this sort of old development model that we had of aid. That's clearly not what's at stake here. That Africa, in many ways, is facing the same issues that countries all over the world are facing. The same kind of policies, just in some cases a much more dramatic way. Mm-hmm. But we all have the same fight and struggle ahead of us. So.
Devlin, it's always great chatting, even when it's very difficult issues, but your insights and knowledge are always really appreciated. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Gwen.
Another one of my favorite people to go to when trying to understand the impact, scope, extent, and reasoning behind resource dispossession in Africa is Frédéric Mousseau of the Oakland Institute. And I had a chance to talk to him on the heels of them having just published their report, Driving Dispossession, the Global Push to Unlock the Economic Potential of Land. And really what this is about is the unprecedented wave of privatization of natural resources that is sweeping the world right now. And again, I focused with Frédéric on the impact of COVID on this phenomenon.
We see that as a very concerning pattern where international institutions and Western countries are really putting pressure on a country to privatize and sell their land. But we already see similar patterns or where Western donors with quotation marks are asking countries to reform. And we've heard the president of the World Bank, Malpass, in March, stating that they were going to have this billions of dollars package for African countries, but that countries will need to follow a certain path of reforms to promote business and to promote, as he said in his own words, a quick recovery. So what Western countries and Western institutions are saying is that we're going to give you emergency assistance. It will be loans, by the way, so it will be your debt, so you'll have to pay back. And to get this emergency assistance, you're going to have to be good for business. And we've seen that with the World Bank that have very specific demands around doing business. They have even a doing business ranking that tells countries, guides countries how to reform their economy so they are more open to business. And we can very legitimately be concerned that the countries and institutions that have really pushed to exploit the continent over the past decades and centuries are going to take this moment or this opportunity to do more of that. And the concerns are legitimate because we've seen already in this kind of statement by Malpass on the conditionality of this aid that this is really the intention. We're going to help you, but you'll have to help our business in exchange.
It sure does harken back to structural adjustment programs, and we saw what a disastrous outcome those had.
Exactly. I mean, the doing business actually was initiated by the World Bank. Doing business ranking was actually initiated by the World Bank the year the structural adjustment programs were phased out. It was really the system that was replacing it. And they had a very bad name on the continent, and doing business has a much better, I mean, it's much better sounding initially for countries and citizens. They are not anymore structurally adjusted. They are improving their business environment, which sounds more positive, but at the end of the day, it does the same thing, because it's really about betting everything on business and exploitation by the private sector of your resources, instead of betting on your own people, instead of saying, okay, we have farmers, pastoralists, we have all this population with so much potential, we need to make the economy work for them. But instead of that, the whole philosophy is we need to give more for exploitation by others. And that's at the end of the day, a disaster for Africa, because this kind of narrative is so now powerful and rooted because of decades of propaganda by former colonial powers and institutions, which are really telling the same thing over and over to African countries.
Another one of my favorite conversations in 2020 was with Ismail Rashid, who is a professor of African history at Vassar University in the United States and a former Amandla contributor. And I turned to him because he's from Sierra Leone. His area of expertise is health and disease. And I was really curious to have him talk about COVID in the context of a country that has grappled with the far more virulent and dangerous Ebola, and what kind of impact that has had on how Sierra Leoneans and the state have dealt with COVID.
We are Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea are the three countries in Africa and the world really that have experienced the longest outbreak of Ebola. Ebola, the Ebola epidemic in those three countries lasted for 2 years, over 11,000 people in the three countries died. I think that well over maybe 40,000, if I'm not sure, about the numbers now, got infected. But for almost 2 years, these three countries were in a state of semi-lockdown or lockdown. So the kind of quarantining, social distancing, making sure that you have safe barriers were things that people had to live with for about 2 years. So there is a social consciousness around pandemics and how to respond to and how to break, you know, chain of transmission. A lot of that success of countering Ebola or stopping Ebola in these three countries were not only done because of international assistance, international solidarity and mobilization. It was also done at the level of people and community organizations becoming aware and responding and taking the right actions to break the chain of transmission. So immediately COVID, once the COVID epidemic reached Sierra Leone, one of the things that was very interesting to see, almost similarly, automatically or quickly, were people putting buckets with water and soap and disinfectants in public places. Outside offices, outside places of worship, when you add schools on, also in schools. So that seemed like a very reflexive action that came from the land experience of Ebola. And quickly, people adopted masks. Although, again, just as in other parts of Africa, is people creatively responded to masking by making masking a fashion statement. Creatively, people design all kinds of masks, so it was easier for people to absorb and to mask, especially in the initial stages. So that was one of the advantages, and this is why in those three countries and in many parts of Africa, I think initially the curve seemed flat, or it seemed as if the spread of the disease was slowed down. But the flip side of Ebola, the Ebola experience, and how you respond to COVID is this. COVID is not Ebola. COVID is not Ebola. And I say COVID is not Ebola because Ebola is a far much more lethal disease. The symptoms of Ebola, especially when people are symptomatic, is far much more evident and far much more frightful. And also, the other thing with Ebola is that Ebola is an affliction that spreads only when people are symptomatic. It's different from COVID. So how is COVID different, and how is it probably affecting people's attitude in Sierra Leone and in many parts of Africa? So one is that people can have symptoms of COVID, spread COVID, recover from COVID without being visibly sick. It's not that you didn't have that with Ebola, but you have that with COVID. Second, as has been demonstrated in other parts of the world, is COVID is a disease for which the mortality rate is higher in particular demographics and in particular groups of people than other groups of people. Ebola did not discriminate based on age or based on where people lived. So if you came into contact with somebody who was infected with Ebola, most likely you'd get Ebola. So with COVID is that all around the world, it's not that kids and young people don't get sick from Ebola, but they recover better from Ebola, from COVID. So this is what is different. So a lot of what's going on in places like Sierra Leone and in other parts of Africa, I think that people are making the kind of calculation that, for example, a country like Sweden has made, is that we might get infected with COVID. It might not be very visible. We might recover from COVID, and the signs might be like a bad flu. But if you have particular demographics, you'll probably get better. It's not, by the way, that COVID is not killing people. It's actually killing people, older people in Sierra Leone. We know a number of people in Sierra Leone who are older, who have gotten sick from COVID and who have died from COVID. But the general sense is that it is not as lethal as Ebola. And as was said in Nigeria, and I'm sure with a number of people in Sierra Leone in terms of their attitude is, look, we might survive COVID, we would not survive starvation.
Last but not least, I spoke to Jeff Wokulira-Segabala. He's new here to Amandla. He's with Witness Radio in Uganda. And it was actually Devlin Kuyek of Grain who has been encouraging me to talk to him for some time now. And I was glad that I heeded his advice. He was really a great guest. We hope to have him back on in 2021. He and I talked about the forced evictions of some 30,000 people in the Kiryandongo region of Uganda. This is a rural peasant population long established in the area, engaged in viable biodiverse agriculture with a sustainable local economy. And yet they are facing eviction by three large foreign agribusiness companies with the complicity of the Ugandan government. It is violent and vicious. And sadly, COVID has played a role in heightening state repression in Uganda. So here's a little bit of our conversation on that.
In Uganda, we have about 75% of our land is untitled. So communities have lived on this land, on their pieces of land, without any disturbance. So what happens is that when an investor comes is brought by brokers, so what happens is they take them to the president. They do not even go through systems of investors like investment authority for them to be registered, and then they are taken to the president, and from the office of the president, they are promised land. And what happens is they move straight from the president to the land commission, or the land commission, which is an entity responsible for giving land titles and the marking land for development. So titles are given without doing any feasibility study, without following any due process of land acquisition. So what we see is that once they have acquired fraudulently the land titles, they tend to go to communities with guns and whatever sort of power they move with, just to go and order communities to go. So it is really corruption which is causing all this mess. And companies and individuals in this country should be, and all those investors should be condemned for using such unlawful land acquisition that have been really used to dispossess the poor communities.
The report really is a tale of complicity and duplicity between government and business. And I'd like you to maybe, in the report, you mentioned that at one point, a member of parliament invites 10 community leaders to come meet with him to talk about the situation, to talk about how, you know, everybody can come out a winner in all of this. And so while they're off at the meeting with the member of parliament in goodwill, something happens on the ground in the communities during their absence. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about that story?
I mean, it was really tactical to withdraw the 10 or more members of the communities to go and meet the member of parliament. That was a gate opening for the violence, because the moment those 10 leaders left their respective communities, they went for the meeting. So that is when companies invaded the community's land, and they started really using force, firing tear gas, live bullets. And even those members who had gone to meet the member of parliament, they ended up being arrested And they were slapped with criminal charges, like inciting violence, arson, and many other things. So they even actually spent, they spent more than 10 days in detention, illegally detained. So by the time they bought their freedom from police, the companies had already taken a possession and that they already entered on the land. So it was too difficult for them to push the company out because they had already entered on the land and they had started really investment. So this is where the problem is. Because of corruption, so these companies bribe police, the National Army, private security guards to lead them in the illegal evictions. Because none of the companies we're talking about has a court action, either court order or whatever, that really requires people to go to leave their land. No, it's not there. It is really violence, and has been violence, and continues to use the violence to take the remaining land, which the communities are insisting that they should not go until a due process is subjected to them.
How much land is remaining at this point in the hands of the community?
We're talking about the total land is about 10,000 square miles. Ideally, about, if it's really big, about 20%, about 20%, because most of our families, they are living within plantations. Their land has been dug up to their verandas, so they have nowhere to grow food from. Their animals are impounded day in, day out. We are seeing more violence, like illegal arrest and detention. We are seeing rape and sexual assault against women and girls. And the district police is condoning this. We have raised this before police. No perpetrator of these abuses or violations have been brought to book. So we are seeing kidnap and many other things. So the little land that is still there, they are really fighting hard that they demolish people's houses, push off the communities, and they take full control.
I am only woman plays instrument in Jinja.
She's a wizard.
Maybe God wanted to break me like a boy. That's why I stay like that.
We'll be right back.
started to play with them, I used to fear, but now I don't fear again. I'm free.
Welcome back, Amandla listeners. And so for this next piece, I spoke to Ameth, who is a dear friend of Amandla over the years. And my one curious question was to find out about more about what was happening in Mali. As we all know, this is a country that is of much importance to Africa, one of the greatest kingdoms to be in Africa. And so I just wanted to understand what the realities in 2020 were in terms of their political systems and what people were asking for and what was really going on. And so here's just a little piece of my conversation with Ameth in 2020.
As you mentioned, there has been a coup last couple of weeks. And then where we're at right now is that there's a push from the ECOWAS, which is the regional body in West Africa and the international community, to ask for a quick return to the old institutional order. And as I understand, the military who are in power right now are trying to maneuver with the political opposition forces to come up with a plan for the transition in terms of how long it will take, who will lead it. But for me, the most important thing is that the content that should have to be going into that transition. Because I mentioned to a lot of friends that the biggest mistake that Mali can do at this point in time is having to go back quickly to a return of the institutional order without transforming the framework of governance in the country. If they don't do that, they will go back to the to a new order, but the causes of the crisis will still be the same. In my sense, they need to take the time necessary based on the consensus of major actors, the armies, the political opposition forces, and even those who are in power up to now, to come up with a consensus on the framework of governance in which under which the state have to run going forward, and also have the chance to address the question of the security in the country, the presence of the military forces in the country, what role should it be. Right now you have a total of around 20,000 armed forces from France, from the United Nations, from ECOWAS, etc., who are stationed within the country. And for 7 years, they haven't been able to defeat what is called the jihadist forces that are maybe 3,000 or 4,000. This is a serious issue. So what role the new leadership will have to take in terms of resolving the security question that is going to have an impact to the whole region? Those for me are the fundamental questions that the transition have to address. The question of the distribution of power between the president, the National Assembly, the judicial system, what role the country have to play in the region. All those questions are very fundamental. So if they would like to move very quickly back into a process of electing a new president and then giving back the power to the civilian authorities, that would be considered to me as not resolving the issue, but just creating a condition for the problem to arise again in a couple of years.
Well, thank you very much. That, I think, gives a good base on it. But you got me when you said to create a consensus between all these major actors. So people have to speak to each other at some point. They will have to get to an understanding. But one thing that people tend to say is, a lot of Africans are not very trustworthy of military transitions power. So the military holding the presidential seat or the prime minister seat. So there's a lot of distrust for that, whether it's warranted or not. Just in a general sense, Africans are not usually for that. But you seem to be hopeful that this could be could shed some light in, like, okay, what is the next step for Malians? Could you speak about that and the ability for that consensus to happen, given the international scene being so involved? Because we also have to remember there's part of these major actors. These international bodies are big actors, per se, in what could happen next. So
yeah, I mean, a lot of people don't trust really the military is leading a key role in the transition, which can be understandable because as Thomas Sankara, the former president of Burkina Faso, used to say, a military without a political conscience is like a potential criminal. So the military, if they don't have a political vision of what to do with the country, what to do in terms of their of a process of transformation, they may be into power, but they wouldn't know what to do. In a couple very short period of time, you will see that they're not going anywhere. So it's normal that the population is skeptical. And then what I've been saying is that people, the popular movement that have been in the street for weeks and weeks and that pushed the situation to a point where the military were able to intervene, have to keep the pressure on the military side also to make sure that they will not hijack the popular movement on their own for their own agenda and not lead the country in the right direction. So that's why it's important at this point in time to have a large consensus on the fundamental issues, the issue of governance, the issue of regaining the sovereignty of the country, the issue of resolving the security question in the country, which role the ECOWAS or the African Union have to play, the question of certain area of the country that have been a little bit marginalized from an economic or social point of view, how to resolve all those fundamental questions should be the one on the table of the transition, rather than having to jump into who will be leading the transition, who will be the, how they're gonna share the ministries within the government, those kind of things. And I'm afraid that right now there are some forces who are pushing it to go into that direction, but that would be a mistake if we don't go into this fundamental issue that I raised that have to be discussed before to put a content first on the transition before to decide collectively who will be leading the execution plan for that transition.
Freedom for some is freedom for none.
Nuestro país no lanza bombas contra otros pueblos, ni manda miles de aviones a bombardear ciudades. Nuestro país no posee armas nucleares, ni armas químicas, ni armas biológicas. La decena de miles de científicos con que cuenta nuestro país y sus médicos han sido educados en la idea de salvar vida. Y ese es el orgullo de nuestros médicos y de nuestro centro de investigación. Decenas de miles de médicos cubanos han prestado servicios internacionalistas en los lugares más apartados e inhóspitos. Un día dije que nosotros no podíamos ni enviaríamos nunca o nunca realizaríamos ataques preventivos y sorpresivos contra ningún oscuro rincón del mundo. Pero que en cambio nuestro país era capaz de enviar los médicos que se necesiten a los más oscuros rincones del mundo. Médicos y no bombas. Médicos y no armas inteligentes de certera puntería. Porque al fin y al cabo, un arma que mata traicioneramente no es absolutamente un arma inteligente.
You've just heard Fidel Castro, after he had retired and was probably able to rest at home and be peaceful, giving a speech about international solidarity in the context of Cuba and the world. Why do I bring up Castro? Because very early on, Cuba and his and its people took charge of how they would deal with the COVID crisis very early on, where ships were abandoned at sea with passengers suffering from COVID, and nation after nation and port after port refused them. Cuba accepted them and said, we'll look after you. And very early on, as Italy was the first European country to be so terribly afflicted by what was going on with COVID, the Cubans sent a team of medical workers to assist in the hospitals of Italy. And just this week, 500 workers have been dispatched from Cuba to Mexico, where their health system is totally incapable of dealing with the fact that their government has done absolutely pathetic job of fighting the COVID crisis. Castro was saying, our country does not launch bombs against other people or send thousands of planes to bomb cities. Our country does not have nuclear weapons, chemical or biological. The tens of thousands of scientists and doctors which our country has were educated to save lives. That is the pride of our doctors and research centers. Tens of thousands of Cuban doctors have provided international service in the uttermost and inhospitable places. One day, I said, they'll never send or never make preventive or surprise attacks against any dark corner of the world. But instead, our country will be able to send the doctors that will be needed in the darkest corners of the world. Doctors, not bombs. Doctors, not smart weapons for accurate targeting. Because at the end of the day, a weapon that kills treacherously is absolutely not a smart weapon. Well, Cuba has lived up to those principles and has stands in stark contrast for anybody who cares to notice the disaster going on in the United States, Mexico, and Brazil because of a system that leaves private health care to individuals to exploit and has left tragic results in its place. Now we have COVID hoarding, vaccine hoarding and vaccine apartheid, where the poorer countries are being deprived of access to the vaccines. Cuba will not be one of those. Cuba has stood fast and been very forward in its approach to dealing with COVID and in its international solidarity with nations suffering from COVID. In February, our comrade and contributor Ole Gierstad brought the focus back to an historical issue called the Land and Freedom Movement, and the leader of that struggle, Dedan Kamati's role in Kenya during what was once upon a time called the Mau Mau Rebellion. A book had been published in 1968 by Don Barnett and Kenyan Karari Njama, who had been a leader in the Land and Freedom Army. And it had gone out of print ever since then. But a couple of new academic works attracted Uli's attention. And so we reviewed those. And what do you know? Daraja Press, the being run by our old friend Firoz Manji, is about to release an updated version of the book, Mau Mau from Within, an analysis of Kenya's peasant revolt, updated with new interviews and references to new information. Firoz is co-publishing that with the Monthly Review Press and Awaz Press, and you can get that at darajapress.com. Welcome back to Amandla. That's it for tonight, ladies and gentlemen. We are about to pack it up. But before we go, I'd like to just invite my colleagues, Helden and Gwen, to talk a little bit about what they think should be our priority for next year. Helden, what do you think you're going to look at, or what are you planning to look at?
I'm aspiring to have more conversations surrounding feminist conversations to solutions to Africa. I would really love to talk to some African women who are doing things on ground or in the diaspora in regards to anything that just advances this Amandla spirit of the African continent. And another thing is that I would also want to invite more youth to the table, to the Amandla table, and see how we can continue on the fight that we have taken on as Amandla over the years.
That's fantastic.
That's fantastic.
That means that Doug and I can retire, which is fabulous.
Of course not.
Thank you, Helden. No. This can be our commitment, is handing the mantle over this year. Yay! Okay, well, I very quickly, the couple of things that I have an eye on is Western Sahara. We have to return to Western Sahara.
Oh, that's right.
It is a critical issue. There were some huge developments in 2020 that we were not able to address. It has to be addressed in 2021. Perhaps with the change of regime in the United States, the story will modify somewhat, but not in the large parameters. So that's really something that we need to look at. And I want to return to resources, the issue of resources, and in particular, Canadian mining interests on the continent. So I personally am committing for 2021 to getting back to some of those issues. Doug?
Well, I've already mentioned the fact that the Mau Mau book has been redone. The book that was produced by Dan Barnett and Karari Njama back in 1968 has been redone by Daraja Press and is now available. I'm very concerned that COVID is not finished. And I'm very, very concerned that in many cases, we are hearing that vaccine might not be available to even to frontline health workers in Africa until the end of 2021. This is called vaccine apartheid. And we really must address this issue. We must do something with our government. So I'm going to try to follow that up, find more about it, and make sure things happen. So there we are, ladies and gentlemen. There's the past over the last three shows and now the future. So stay tuned to Jazz Euphorium.
Africa unite, Fatsile Lile. Africa unite, Fatsile Lile.
Summa zele zele. Other than that, I mean, you know, what's going on? What do you say?
Buenas tardes.
And we'll be back.
Missed your favorite show? Not a problem. Go to www.ckut.ca and follow the link to CKUT's easy-to-use archives. Instructions are on the page. 2 months' worth of archives are stored in mono and half a month's worth in stereo.
Pleasant good afternoon to you, Montreal.
If you're having trouble, please email sys@ckut.ca. That's sys@ckut.ca.
Oh, yeah! I want to be your motivator.
This message is intended for all Quebecers. We must take extreme measures to curb the pandemic. Only essential services remain open. Gatherings are prohibited. It's forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. These efforts aim to protect our healthcare workers, seniors, and loved ones. Let's comply with the lockdown and curfew to lower the risk of contracting COVID-19, because our health is important. For more information, visit quebec.ca/confinement. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Sound.
C. K. K.
U.
T. T. 90.3 FM.
Another reliable communication channel.